Republican lawmakers set out to curb voter power by introducing several bills to weaken citizen initiatives. But if all of them pass, opponents predict chaos. Chaos is a familiar state on the House floor, where Republican lawmakers passed a ban on trans girls in school sports after nearly 6 hours of debate. What are the bill's chances in the Senate? And what does it mean for an already nasty Senate primary? And Governor Ducey completed one legislative priority this week when he signed a sweeping mental health bill. Where do the rest of his priorities stand? We'll get into all that this week on The Breakdown. Welcome back to The Breakdown podcast, listeners. I'm Julia Shumway, Senate reporter at the Arizona Capital Times, joined in studio, as usual, by Dylan Rosenblatt, our courts and education reporter, Aaron Kimball-Sanit, our House reporter, and Andrew Nikla, who covers the governor's office. Dylan had our cover story this week, kind of an unexpected, unintended consequences story of just what might happen if Republican lawmakers have their way and pass a handful of bills that are intended to curb voter power. So we've seen over the past few decades, honestly, that while liberals are not successful typically in passing legislation through the regular legislative process, they are able to win at the ballot box by passing citizen initiatives. And that leads Republicans to try to pass various bills that weaken the citizen initiative process. To start off with, Dylan, can you tell us about three of those bills introduced by House Speaker Rusty Bowers, Representative Anthony Kern, and Senator Vince Leach that do want to curb voter power?
So like you said, there's three that I focused on in my story. There's plenty of other ballot referrals that members of the legislature are trying to get onto the ballot in this next election that I did not focus on because I don't think we could have had room for a 5,000 plus word story, which I very much could have written about every single one of these ballot referrals. So let's start with House Speaker Rusty Bowers, who wants to, through his HCR 2046, come up with this reauthorization process that would make it so every single ballot initiative or proposition that already passed and will pass in the future, has to come back every 10 years. That's starting in 2020. Going back since 1994, all of the ballot propositions that have passed between 94 and 2018, there are 65 that I counted that were successful, would be 30 years from the time that they were enacted. So the ones in 1994 would be on the ballot in 2024.
So hang on just a minute. If we are re-voting on all of these ballot measures that have already been passed, what are some of the measures that might seem kind of weird when they come up again for votes?
There's a few that I noticed, and I'll talk about one that ended up on the cutting room floor from the story because I think it's a fun one, especially with the things that I've been covering. For the other ones that I don't get into on this podcast, read the story, please. But the Corporation Commission was expanded from 3 to 5 seats in 2000. That was, the voters approved that. So if that comes back onto the ballot in 2030 and voters turn it down, what happens to those 2 seats? Like, no, the people I talked to, like, nobody knows because the way that Bowers has his bill written, it doesn't expressly state what happens if voters turn these down. Does it get wiped off from the books? Like, we don't know. I'm curious what happens with the Corporation Commission one because there's 2 people who are holding elected office who would they wait until their terms are done? Like, this is nobody was able to answer these questions. Other ones I did focus on in the story, the Voter Protection Act, which we'll come back to at several points during this discussion, Julia, because one of the bills actually does focus on the Voter Protection Act specifically, but that was approved in 1998 and it gives, like its name states, voters protection on the things that they're able to get into law. The lawmakers and the governor are not able to amend or repeal anything that is voter approved without the legislature getting three-fourths vote in both chambers, which has become a very difficult task because seemingly nobody wants to work with the other party.
And let's jump to the Voter Protection Act and the specific bill that would address the Voter Protection Act. This is sponsored by Senator Vince Leach over in the Senate. What does Senator Leach want to do, and why does he want to find a way to repeal or change the Voter Protection Act?
He wants to make the Voter Protection Act amendable with just a simple majority vote in the House and the Senate. So right now, like I said just a couple seconds ago, you need 3/4 in both chambers. with a simple majority, if one party, specifically right now the Republican Party, has control in both chambers, they're able to change anything that the voters put forth in general. However, Leach only has it mentioned as this will affect anything that is health or public safety. He himself said that's a very broad interpretation. Like, there's nothing that really explicitly states what voter-approved propositions are health slash public safety. But he mentioned in his testimony when this bill moved through committee that he was specifically targeting the Arizona Medical Marijuana Act of 2010 and the minimum wage increase from 2016, both of which would include health and public safety. Also, people who have been paying attention to reporting going around the state that I've been doing and other reporters in general, there's going to be an effort on the ballot to legalize recreational adult use marijuana. And this is a way that they're able to amend things that they don't like in that effort, but they would have to wait a minimum of 1 year.
And if you are a regular listener, you probably remember that just last week we were talking about medical marijuana legislation that stalled this year because of the Voter Protection Act, because even though it had the votes in the Senate, it didn't have enough votes to pass with a 3/4 majority, just a simple majority. So obviously this measure from Senator Leach would change that. Now, there's a third bill that you wrote about in the context of the story from Representative Anthony Kern. What would that bill do?
So that one's called the single subject ballot referral. It limits any initiative that citizens would have to collect signatures for to just one subject. And for those who don't understand why people are upset with this proposal from Representative Kern, he made the argument that ballot initiatives and referendums should be like what the legislature has to deal with, where their bills that they file are only limited to one subject. Well, the legislature also files like 1,300 bills a session. So that's why they can get away with doing these for one subject. And just by filing a bill doesn't cost them roughly like $1 million to get it to go anywhere. At least I would hope not. I mean, that would be a lot of money going into the legislative process. But for the initiatives, it's a much easier way for citizens to get things turned into law that they're not able to get through the legislature. They have maybe two, sometimes more, subjects that go into it. I'll bring the 2016 minimum wage increase as an example. Like, that has more than one subject because not only was it a minimum wage increase, but it also involved workers being able to get paid sick leave. So under Kern's new referendum, if voters would approve it, something along those lines wouldn't be able to make it onto the ballot. And like I said, with the amount of money that goes into it, they would have to file two separate initiatives, which cost like twice the amount of money for signatures, and then for the yes or no campaigns that would go into it as well.
So those are these three bills. Part of what your story focused on was how these, if all three of them passed, how the way they interact could create what opponents described as just complete chaos for ballot initiatives in Arizona. What are some of the ways that these bills could conflict or create confusion for lawyers to deal with in the years to come?
So the main focus of my story was how Bowers' HCR 2046 and Anthony Kern's HCR 2032 would be able to work in unison in a way if both of them are approved by the voters. Obviously, the Voter Protection Act comes into play no matter what is approved on the ballot. But these two specifically, because Bowers wants every single approved proposition dating back to 1994 to be back onto the ballot to see if voters still think it should be a law, and Kern's limiting things to a single subject raised the question of, okay, out of the 65 already approved propositions from that time span, how many of them are more than one subject, and would they be able to qualify for the ballot under Bowers's proposal? And that's what I set to find out. I talked to a couple of lawyers about this, and what Mike Braun, the executive director of the Ledge Council, said, I think the best is not as simple as saying both of these are, once they're approved, they're able to work together, since neither one of them subtly references the other. like Kern didn't have in his language of the bill that this would affect retroactively, or it would reference Bowers's bill saying like, yes, like it would apply to anything that would have to be reauthorized. It doesn't mention that. That doesn't mean that it's not going to happen, but Democratic elections lawyer Rupali Desai said they can still find a way to have these work together. And in that case, she said there will be litigation. And another Republican lawyer that I talked to, Tom Basile, who works over at Statecraft, said, agreed with Desai. He's like, yeah, like there would be litigation. Like, it's not impossible for this to happen. But again, they still would have to go through an extra step along the way. So that way these two could work together.
And at this point, how are all three of these resolutions moving through the legislative process?
Kern's is the only one that made it out of its chamber of origin, so it went through the House on party lines. Vince Leach's voter protection amendment referral has been cowed in the Senate, but has not gotten a third read. And Bowers has not yet scheduled it to be cowed or third read yet. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen with those two. But there's a lot of ballot referrals that are making its way through.
Great. And for our less wonky listeners, that means that Kearns probably has the best bill of passing right now. We gave Senator Leach's an initial vote of approval in the Senate, but it needs to come up for a full roll call vote to move. And Bowers's sounds like it's kind of dead.
It all comes down to Bowers, really. I mean, he's the House Speaker, so he's the one who gets to assign when things are going to be on the agenda for the day. So he didn't return my call. I'm going to try and keep talking, or try to get him to at least answer what's up with this, and if he plans to schedule it, or if maybe if they're just going to wait for the budget to get done, whenever that may be, before they start moving some of these.
And Speaker Bowers, if you're one of our loyal listeners, give Dylan a call back, please. With that, we're going to wrap up the first half of our show, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some other stuff that went down in the House this week. Namely, why they spent 6 hours on the floor debating a single bill on Tuesday.
Can't wait for your weekly Arizona Capital Times? Then subscribe to the Yellow Sheet Report. The Yellow Sheet Report brings you the latest news and hottest political gossip in town every day, thanks to our trusty team of reporters and railbirds with their great tips. And with the legislative session seemingly never ending, the time is now to get in the know with the Yellow Sheet Report. Learn more at yellowsheetreport.com today.
Welcome back to the Breakdown Podcast, listeners. I'm still Julia Shumway, your Senate reporter, joined for this half of the show by Aaron Kimball Sanit, my colleague over in the House, who seems to spend a ridiculous amount of time on the floor with House lawmakers because they spend a ridiculous amount of time on the floor, including about 6 hours last week discussing a bill that would bar some girls from playing girls' sports. I'm sure our listeners are very, very familiar with what exactly this bill would do, but what is Nancy Bardo trying to accomplish?
So Representative Nancy Bardo, as she would put it, is trying to ensure that there is a level playing field in girls' sports. What she means by that is that she feels that there is apparently a rash, or the potential for a rash, of trans girls who are people who are assigned a male gender identity at birth but now identify as female, participating in girls' interscholastic and collegiate sports. Bartow and other conservatives in the legislature, as well as some conservative advocacy organizations, are warning that this kind of thing could rob girls who are assigned female at birth the opportunity to win, basically, on a level playing field, which they fear can rob them of, you know, scholarships, things like that in the future. They slugged it out over the course of 5 hours on Tuesday, and as the dust settled, the bill emerged on party lines 31-29.
And I know you've been looking into some of the politics around this vote. It's not a simple policy debate. What have you been hearing about some of the reasons beyond just wanting to protect the integrity of girls' sports that Nancy Bardo might have for introducing and pushing for this legislation this year in particular?
So there's a handful of things. You know, the first thing to understand is that this is legislation that is favored heavily by a couple of kind of key conservative groups who are active in Arizona. The Alliance Defending Freedom, who has been responsible for lawsuits in other states in which trans girls have been repeatedly victorious in interscholastic sports. Connecticut is kind of the current hallmark lawsuit. There are no cases in Arizona yet, as well as Kathy Herod's Center for Arizona Policy, which is a conservative, religious, evangelical, I guess, think tank of a sorts based out of Arizona that is responsible for lobbying on behalf of lots of legislation that really leans in to conservative social and religious morality. So that's one political factor. There's powerful groups basically at play here. The second political consideration here is that Nancy Bartow is mounting a primary challenge to her Senate seatmate, Heather Carter. Carter is one of the Senate's most moderate Republicans. She and a couple of other moderates in that chamber could very well kill this legislation should it ever get a hearing across the courtyard in the Senate. Bartow, by kind of leaning into a red meat conservative issue like this, can kind of try to force Carter's hand either to vote for this bill or vote against it and potentially alienate a conservative base and a constituency in the district that Bartow insists is in support of this legislation. In fact, she told me when I pushed her to kind of acknowledge the political reality here, instead of just insisting that this is purely a policy consideration. And she basically responded by saying, well, yeah, it would be in my opponent's best interest to vote for this bill, considering the supposed support that it has among her constituency. And she had a similar message for the chamber's kind of other key moderate vote, Kate Brophy McGee, who also faces a tough election, albeit a general election, in Senate District 28.
Wow, that's almost a mobster-type policy here at the House. If you know what's good for you, you'll vote for my bill. Was it something that passed easily out of the House? I know there was a lot of protracted debate there, but were there some Republicans who were still iffy about voting for this?
House Republicans debated the legislation in a caucus meeting, I think a week or two before it got a debate and vote on the floor. And in that caucus meeting, which I attended, it really kind of seemed like there were some Republicans who aren't even particularly moderate, who were concerned about aspects of the bill. Now, initially, just as means of background, the legislation was written so that virtually anybody could call into question whether a girl on a interscholastic team was representing their gender, I suppose, correctly in the framework of the legislation. It doesn't really limit who can make this allegation or what burden of proof that they need. And in order to verify that their biological sex is female, their sex is assigned at birth, the legislation initially required a signed doctor's note that, among other things, attested to the student's internal and external reproductive anatomy, as well as their chromosomes and their genetics, a bunch of stuff. And some Republicans, those through which a libertarian streak runs, were a little concerned about how invasive it could potentially be to force students to be to have their reproductive anatomy examined by their doctors just because a sore loser on the other team accuses them of misrepresenting their gender. And that seemed to make some people uncomfortable, and they expressed that much in the caucus meeting. People were also worried about the timing. Again, there is still a budget that we haven't really made a whole lot of headway on that I think lawmakers really want to get done. And they were worried that this is something that could distract from that. But by the time we debated the bill on the floor, Bartow had introduced a floor amendment that basically limited the types of testing that would be required to solely a genetic test, which could be accomplished through a cheek swab or a blood test. You know, Democrats would argue that any kind of invasive testing is invasive testing, even if it doesn't require stripping naked and showing your doctor your reproductive anatomy. But it seemed to assuage concerns by some Republicans because they all voted for it, despite expressing hesitance at various points.
So we've also seen quite a bit of opposition to this bill from the business community, including the Arizona Diamondbacks, some other big employers in town. What does that mean? That obviously didn't seem to sway Republicans and the House either way.
I think there were something like 200 businesses that signed onto a letter basically pleading with lawmakers not to go forward with this. Diamondbacks, as you mentioned, PayPal, a variety of local organizations and firms, national ones, like I mentioned. You know, the funny thing is that opposition from the business community has historically been one of the few ways in which the minority party can exercise leverage over the Republicans when they try to do something that just enmeshes the state in controversy. I mean, look back at SB 1070, for example, or more recently, the Sanctuary City ballot referral. And Democrats in press conferences and on the floor, in addition to a variety of advocacy groups, all bandied about this letter of business opposition saying that this bill will cost the state X amount of dollars. This is a bad idea. It's a blemish. It's a black eye for the state's reputation, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think it's interesting because Republicans did not really seem to be bothered. A lot of Republicans in Arizona are motivated by business interests more than social issues. Many of them are financial or fiscal conservatives more than social conservatives. But, you know, I think really for the first time on a couple issues this session, this one and maybe Sanctuary Cities as well, you're seeing Republicans basically accusing the business community of misunderstanding their interests and their position or being unnecessarily risk averse. You know, I talked to Bartow about this and she said, wait, the business community never wants us to discuss controversial issues. They're risk averse and they just don't understand why we view it's important to do something like this. So it almost seems that as if there's a degree of diminishing returns for how often progressives can use the business community as a bargaining chip, or just that, you know, frankly, Republicans have maybe become more ideological in this day and age or are just less motivated by financial concerns.
That is interesting, given that it was just a few years ago that Governor Brewer vetoed one of the last controversial transgender-related bills that came before the House and the Senate that passed pretty easily out, and then Brewer vetoed this, what was referred to as a bathroom bill, in response to pressure from the business community. And you also mentioned our Sanctuary City ballot referral, which is dead, but was another example of kind of increased rancor between House Democrats and House Republicans. What's your reading on what these big, high-profile, real dirty fights in the legislature mean for, what does it mean for the state of the session going forward?
It was really interesting. I mean, you know, on the floor, we debated this legislation for 5-6 hours. People were crying. It was intensely emotional. You know, accusations of hypocrisy, prejudice, transphobia, et cetera, were lobbed back and forth. You know, the Republicans got great joy out of accusing the Democrats of, quote, denying science. You know, Democrats, of course, often accuse the Republicans of denying science when they deny the scientific reality of climate change. And, you know, in the past, a lot of these disagreements can seem a little superficial. It's relatively common for people to scream at each other when the mics are on and then pat each other on the backs in the hallways. Everybody I talked to said that Tuesday night felt different, that this felt like a real sort of inflection point in the relationship between the two parties in the House, in which the sort of foundational philosophies of each party were contrasted and in which lawmakers from those parties demonstrated that those philosophies are in many ways entirely incompatible. And then in the days since, we've seen a couple issues where it kind of seemed like most, at least moderate Democrats, would get in line behind Republican bills. For example, on John Kavanaugh's Airbnb party houses bill, which just failed yesterday. And we saw Democrats, in essence, pull support of those bills at the last minute. And it's maybe a little bit of a stretch to draw a causal relationship, but Kavanaugh, at the very least, was attuned to this fact that, you know, maybe the leftover tension from Tuesday was leaking into other issues. And, you know, I talked to Democrats about this, too, and I basically put it to them this way. Like, there has to be a point at which it is no longer possible to have a normal interpersonal relationship with your colleague across the aisle when you, by inference, are basically accusing them of being bad people on the floor, on the record, with the entire state potentially watching. So whether this continues in the coming weeks, it remains to be seen. I mean, they could patch things over. They very well might. I asked Rusty Bowers, the Speaker of the House, about this, you know, whether they would ever go back to normal. And he basically said, hey, I don't even know what normal is anymore. So I think that gives you a pretty accurate temperature reading. And the funny thing is that all this damage, all this vitriol could be for nothing because, as I understand it, Julia, this probably won't even pass in the Senate. And you don't even know if the governor's going to sign the thing.
Yeah, its future looks pretty doubtful in the Senate right now. So Senate President Karen Fann told me that she personally supports the bill, but she needs to talk to her caucus members to figure out if it's something they want to see assigned to a committee or brought to the floor. And so far, even though she's had a couple days to talk to people, it hasn't come up for a first read yet. I'll still be watching next week to see if she does end up assigning it. That's a great reason to subscribe to the legislative report. You also mentioned that Senator Heather Carter is a likely no vote on this. She hasn't wanted to talk about it. She's avoided responding to my text messages or phone calls so far. And Senator Brophy McGee is almost certainly a no. She wishes that the bill had not made it over from the House, and she doesn't want to deal with it. Now, Senator Brophy McGee did have one bill she wanted to deal with this week. She passed a unanimously approved by both chambers, actually shortly before the House went into its five-hour-long debate on the transgender sports bill. It passed a Brophy McGee bill that had to do with mental health. This was a priority for Governor Doug Ducey. Andrew, can you tell us a little bit about what's in this bill and what our new unanimously passed state law has to say?
Yeah, so like you said, this was one of his legislative priorities. This was his fourth bill signed of the session and his first priority, one of like dozens that he's called for in his State of the State. The bill, in short, just makes it certain that any insurance company in Arizona covers mental health care the same way that it covers physical health care. It was dubbed Jake's Law after Jake Makovsky. He was an Arizona teenager who died of suicide. He was put in the hospital after he had suicidal thoughts, and he was pulled out because his health care didn't cover what he was getting, and he died shortly after.
So this bill, as we said, was one of the legislative priorities that Governor Ducey laid out in his State of the State. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the first success he's had with one of those priorities this year, right?
Yes. First success he's had so far. I mean, generally, when you look at like the list of things he's asking for, he's having a relatively smooth session. And most of the things he's asking for are slowly moving through, but they're, you know, slowly but surely moving through. Things like his call to make September 25th, Sandra Day O'Connor Civics Education Day is going through. His call to give students on the Navajo Nation ESA vouchers, that's slowly moving through. A couple of key things are still kind of rocky right now. I mean, one thing that's outright dead, of course, is the Sanctuary City referendum. The other thing that appears dead, that is probably going to be more of a budget item, that's his call to eliminate taxes on military pensions. That was voted down in the Senate, and it was, I think it was voted to be reconsidered, but it hasn't been heard, and it's now effectively dead.
Yes. So nothing's dead until we adjourn, sign, you die. That's a thing we've all learned, a painful lesson we've all learned. But the Senate did vote down a bill that Senator David Gowan introduced on behalf of the governor to eliminate taxes on military pensions. Several conservative senators joined the Democrats in killing this. The conservatives don't want a carve-out for individual people, no matter how noble that cause is. And Democrats just don't want a tax cut, period, until we fully fund teacher salaries.
Well, as much as they don't want it, this is something that the governor's office has made clear that they want in their budget. I mean, they actually like released a video today, Friday, overlaying some clips of Ducey's speech saying how he wants to make Arizona a home for veterans. They've spent a lot of money on this messaging. They've spent a lot of time in these like negotiations to, you know, make sure that that this in some way is included in the budget. I don't see them not getting this done.
Right. And one other thing, this actually might be one of the reasons why our budget is moving a little slower than Senate President Fan and House Appropriations Chair Cobb might like it to, is that they have been in negotiations with the Ninth Floor over the past week on issues the governor's office has with the budget that the House and Senate leaders think is okay. One of them, of course, sounds like it is the tax break on veterans' pensions. Another issue that the governor desperately wants included in the budget and House and Senate leaders are not so sure about is Project Rocket. Andrew, where does that stand?
If you ask the governor's office, it's an overwhelmingly popular policy, and that if it was put to a vote today, it would pass. Well, that's what they say. But I mean, it's gotten some harsh criticism from some pretty key members in the House so far. It hasn't made it out of the House yet. It's still actually waiting for a vote. That harsh criticism has made some people concerned that maybe they might have to ask for less money. So, like, in short, they may have to amend it to get it passed. But again, this is another thing that they've spent a lot of time and money on, like, marketing this, and I don't see them backing down on this either.
And one other priority that the governor spelled out in his State of the State address is one that may be held up for political reasons. What's going on with his bill to expand the Teachers Academy?
So the bill specifically opens the Teachers Academy to all college majors, and it allows these graduates of the academy, or these academies in any university that participates, to teach in any public school, or to teach in any school that serves a majority of public school students. And those are being, or that one bill is being shepherded by Paul Boyer. And he and Heather Carter were budget holdouts last year. And Boyer says that his bills have not been scheduled to be heard yet for possibly that reason. That's what we think is happening.
Yeah, and I have a story to that effect in this week's paper if you want to pick up a copy. I think that pretty much wraps up our show for this week. Thank you to Andrew Nikla and Aaron Kimball-Sanit and Dylan Rosenblatt for joining me to talk all about the latest news in Arizona legislative politics. And if the House decides to start hearing bills sponsored by Senator Carter or Senator Boyer, or the Senate decides to wade into this fight over who should get to play girls' sports, or if lawyers decide to start filing lawsuits over initiative laws, you know, you'll hear all about that here on The Breakdown in the Arizona Capital Times, online at azcapitaltimes.com, in the Legislative Report, and in the Yellow Sheet Report. With that, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.